Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, guy.
Hello, Gary. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. We're really thrilled because one of our best friends has got an Oscar nomination.
Yes.
Bill Nye.
Bill Nye, yeah, who's been a great friend to both of us and who we met on one of the first things we did together, which is when we both worked on the film Still Crazy.
That's right. So I met Bill in 1998. We were doing some music for the film. This is a film called Still Crazy about a band called Strange Fruit. It's starring Bill as the lead singer. There was Jimmy Nail was in it, Tim Spool,
all the lads, Stephen Ray,
and it's a band called Strange Fruit that get back together 20 years after they've split up, and it's all that entails. And there's this. Do you remember? There's a scene in it where the guitarist won't do it, and then he finally succumbs, and it's played by Bruce Robinson.
There's Bruce Robinson exactly, who's a sort of Sid Barrett character,
another friend of yours.
Another friend, yes, who I've actually just been staying with. I've got a Blink and You Miss It part in it.
Have
playing
you?
A sort of Noel Gallagher character, yeah.
I blinked.
You clearly blinked.
I obviously blinked. But I had to
coach Jimmy Nail how to play the bass.
I had an interesting job. It was called musical director, but it wasn't really what you'd call a musical director. I had the band for nearly 2 weeks in Nomi's studios, teaching them how to pose as a band, to look like a band. And we just watched old videos. So then Bill would come to my house and we did this whole sort of Peter Gabriel look at one point to one of the songs, because the songs are kind of comedic spoofs of prog.
Oh man, I wish there was video.
I went to the filming and hung out a lot down trying to make this band look like a band, you know, and we all did. It's a great film, and Brian Gibson directed it, sadly no longer with us.
Although I do remember an awful moment with it. Do you remember, Gary, there was a day that we were in Nomis rehearsals with the band and you and I played our submission for The Flame Still Burns, which was the big song in the film, and it was rejected out of hand on the spot?
No, I don't remember that. I've obviously raised it from my mind. Who rejected it?
Brian
Gibson.
Yeah, we started playing it and he was just shaking his head. I'm thinking, oh.
I think we were probably a little bit too spoofy on it. Was that what it was?
We did get very, very spoofy. I think at one point it had the word sods in it, because I remember we were kind of trying to think of words that people used a lot. You're at the back, come on, you sods. It was something like that in it.
Whatever.
But also because Bill is such a huge music fan, which is why, he sang like he'd been in bands for his whole life when he came in. We had another singer ready to do the parts. Because obviously he wasn't going to, the actor's not going to be the singer. So with this poor guy who had learned all the songs that we'd learned, and it was, being produced by Langer and Win Stanley, it was fantastic, the whole thing. And then Bill turned up that first day and it was like, well, no, he's singing him. It was amazing.
Yeah, he was. And we should get him on the show, shouldn't we?
Yeah, I think we should get him on the show. I wonder what our listeners think. I think they'd agree.
We'll persuade Bill, I'm sure. He's a great nerd on rock and roll. He's a big
He knows so much. He's been at so many key gigs. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So today, Belinda Carlisle.
Yes, Belinda Carlisle. Absolutely groundbreaking. It's one of the, you go back and you look at the Go-Go's and it's like, man, they were at the forefront of so much. First all-girl band with a number one who wrote everything. Even a girl manager.
Played every instrument.
They were...
And of course, there's this great British connection, isn't there, with Madness and the Specials who they toured with.
Yeah, it's a really great career arc, and then sort of definitive 80s artist.
Oh yeah, I mean, Heaven Is a Place and I Feel Weak. I mean, some of the greatest pop songs to ever come out of the 80s.
Yeah.
And then rock and roll inductions and Hall of Fame. I mean,
then ending up with kind of Utter Serenity and Yoga in Thailand.
Can I just ask, have you ever played bass with Belinda?
No. I've actually been asked to sort of dep on UK tours twice, but it's that classic, you know, freelance musicians thing of wait all day for a bus and three come at once, and I've never been able to. We won't mention that.
We won't mention that. You didn't play bass.
Shut up. Shut up.
Let's get her on. Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
That's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience.
Oh, yeah, to
get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Hi.
Hello.
Belinda.
Hi, how are you?
Very
fantastic.
Good.
I put my camera on. I know. I have woo-hoo behind me.
You do, yeah. Very close encounters.
I don't know what's going on, but I think I don't
you got a window behind you with bright sun. And...
exactly. And I have some kind of weird filter too. Anyway, I'm being just distracted by that. So, hi.
Thanks for coming on early. Actually, that's the earliest any guest has ever been on our show. You're five minutes early, and that's brilliant.
Wow. And I did GMTV this morning, and then I went on a power walk in the park, and then I came to do this. So I've already had a full day.
Oh, no. So you're bored. So everything we ask you is going to be like second, third time. You're going to be bored.
No. That's not how we roll.
We're different.
I know.
So you're rehearsing because I spoke to I texted my friend Toby Chapman last night. Toby played with Spandau Ballet back in the 80s. And he just produced my solo record 2 years ago. And Toby said, I'm just on my way to rehearse with Belinda.
Right. Toby's been, every time I come to the UK, he's for the most part of the band, unless he's busy with somebody else. So
James Nesbitt,
of course.
Lovely.
And
James,
I've been working with him for over 20 years now, maybe 25 years. And I have a great band, Dave Taggart, Alex Tuff, Andy Carr. So you guys probably know them from around.
Weren't you meant to tour with the Go-Go's with Billy Idol, just before COVID? Is that going to happen again?
No, I don't think the Go-Go's are defunct. They've gone. So
they're the Gongons.
After the Rock Hall thing the Rock Hall induction, and we just all sort of decided that it would be nice to end on a high note, and we were planning to do Billy, but that was still like the end of COVID. So, and then he had a vocal problem. So it just didn't work out.
That's a shame. I must say, it's been so fantastic diving into the history of you and the, I mean, you've certainly had the absolute full arc.
Right.
Really, everything, with the band in every way.
Yeah.
And it's magnificent. But also just to remember how important and groundbreaking the Go-Go's were when you started.
Right. Well, we had no idea how to do anything. So, back then in the early, very early punk days in LA, there were like 50 kids and I was one of them. And everybody we knew was in a band and they were horrible. So we thought, well, we can be in a band and be horrible too. And it was kind of cool to be horrible. So that's how we started.
Let's just go back a little bit.
There is one question. Because also there's the thing of information back then, because now everyone knows everything. It's because you would have been getting NMEs that were 3 weeks old or something, wouldn't you?
Exactly. Well, in high school, we used to go to the local record store and buy NME and Melody Maker. And, we were like just, mesmerized by the early punk movement, the Sex Pistols and, Sham 69, all those bands back then. So I was kind of, that was it for us. I think we were all influenced by the scene in LA, but it was DIY from the beginning, we were very much influenced by that scene. I think for the Go-Go's, especially the Buzzcocks and more melodic punk bands, but I mean, that's how it all started in LA and for us, is if it wasn't for Well, for me, if it wasn't for Iggy Pop, which I saw, you know, in high school, seeing the cover of Raw Power, I just, you know, kind of freaked out and discovered this whole new world of music that wasn't being played on the radio. So that was in high school. So,
where was high school? Was that in the Valley? Where were you growing up?
I was born and raised in Hollywood, and I grew up in the Valley in Burbank.
But not in Hollywood, not Hollywood, Hollywood.
No, I was born in Hollywood. No, but I mean, Hollywood.
Not glitz, it wasn't glitzy Hollywood.
No, it wasn't back then. No, it was, I was born there. I grew up a lot in Thousand Oaks, which is about 45 minutes from LA, and then in the Valley. And that's.
Were you totally like Frank Zappa's version of a Valley girl, do you think? Hanging out in the mall.
Well, I mean, I tried not to be, you know, I am a Valley girl. I mean, that's my formative years were spent in the Valley. So I guess I still am. Once a Valley girl, always a Valley girl.
You're so 818.
I know. Exactly. We used to be embarrassed by our area codes. It was like, are you 213 or 818?
Yeah.
And if you were 818, it was
310, of course. Yeah.
Exactly.
Because it was funny for us. I remember when we first heard of there being an LA punk scene, because it was way after there. To us in England, it was like, you know, you're talking about school kids who have cars and swimming pools.
I know.
What are you complaining about?
Exactly. Oh, I know. It's funny because I think that every punk scene around the world had a different sort of, I don't know, vibe. And in growing up in Southern California, there was not a whole lot to be angry about. So, you know, there was all that faux anger, of course, and early go-go songs. But there really wasn't anything to be pissed off about at the time, you know. And New York was more sort of junky, dark undertones. Detroit was very working class, you know, hardcore. LA was, there was a lot of art infused into the early days, and it was a lot more sort of effervescent. I mean, there's faux anger, of course, but at the end of the day, it was pretty sparkly. I'd say that's how I would describe it, sparkly.
But also, yeah, because if you look at, you're absolutely right on the art front, because the LA, looking at it now, all the LA stuff had in terms of like graphics and how people looked was a lot, you know, it was leaning almost more towards what Gary was about to do.
Yeah, exactly.
More
neuromantic. It was colorful, you know, I mean, it was, there's a lot of art that was going on in Southern California outside of the music, was sort of infused in the music. So it was different. I knew at the time, I think we all knew that we were a part of something very special.
So what was the first musical thing you did? Because was it with the Germs?
It was in the Germs. Actually, it was funny because Pat Smear, who's in the Foo Fighters, that was our first band. And I was like 17. He was like six. I think he's a year younger than me, a year or two younger. So that was our first band. And we actually played the first punk show in LA at a place called the Orpheum Theater. And I was the drummer that never played, though, because I came
We just played the Orpheum, didn't we, Guy? Did we just play the Orpheum?
Yeah. Was it the Orpheum we played?
We played the Orpheum.
I don't know if it's the same one. This one is on Holloway. Yeah. I don't think it's there anymore.
Oh, okay.
But it was like maybe 20 people showed up. And I was the drummer, but I had come down with mononucleosis, the kissing disease, back then. And so I had to go back home to my parents to recover. And then when I came back, so they got somebody to fill in for drums. And so I was sort of like the Germs prop person. So I would hand Darby like salad dressing and peanut butter and broken glass. And that was my job.
And my God. So kissing some boy nearly got you out of music.
Exactly. You know? I know. Exactly. It sort of sidelined me for a while. So then I was in a band called Black Randy and the Metro Squad that did an album called Pass the Dust, I Think I'm Bowie. And
he was such a great total name.
Oh my God. That's so brilliant.
Total genius. And then during Black Randy is when, about 1978 is when we decided to form the Go-Go's, and there was still a very, very small punk scene. Very small.
I can't believe that poor Pat had to wait till the 90s to get successful.
I know. I know. It was really funny because when we stayed in touch through the years, and when the Go-Go's and the Foo Fighters were going to be inducted into the Rock Hall, we called each other and thought, who would have guessed from the Germs Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? So it was very, very sweet. And after the induction, we did a Germs song at a party. So we did an homage to Darby. Yeah, it was great. It was great.
One thing I do want to ask about this time, because because Sex Pistols gigs seem to come up for one reason or another in this podcast. Right. Well, one reason. Were you one of the ones who did the pilgrimage to Winterland?
Yes. I was right in the front.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
That's amazing.
That's the last gig, isn't
the last gig.
That was the last gig,
Ever get the feeling? Did you hear him say, ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
Yes, I did. I was there.
Oh, my God. That's the punk equivalent of the Bob Dylan Judas moment, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
What I like about this program as well, because we hear it a lot, is this passing of the baton, that there's someone in every audience that is going to be on a stage and be successful within the next generation. I mean, this is a great example.
Completely. And that was when we thought we were, I remember it was kind of disappointing. That show was very disappointing. And, you know, of course we all built it up. It was going to be something amazing, and it was amazing in its own way, but it was also,
Sid couldn't really play. I mean, let's face it, Sid couldn't play. Because I saw, can I just say, did you know I've seen the Sex Pistols guy?
Go on.
I drive him mad with this because he never saw them. But when I saw them, it was Glenn Matlock playing bass. It was a musical unit, you know, and I think it had really fallen apart by the time they hit Winterland.
Yeah, I think so.
They were talking to each other, were they? Malcolm had already decided that Johnny was out, and it was...
Yeah, it was a mess, but it inspired us to want to do something. We felt like we were like the next step, you know, and even though we had no idea how to do anything, we just thought, we can do it. So, I mean, it was... You know,
but that's brilliant, because it could have been utterly demoralizing, couldn't it? You're going
it could have been
the source, and then that's brilliant. You turn that around.
So what is it? Because we all know that the fact that the Go-Go's were, apparently, history tells us, the first all female band to play all their instruments and write their own songs to
and
reach number one.
What gets overlooked, and the fact that you had a female manager.
Yeah, and we had female roadies too.
So what happened? Was it a kind of a philosophical idea you all had? We've got to get together and just have women.
No, I mean, it was just like we wanted to have a party. It was just for a laugh. And it wasn't, we had no sort of, we just wanted to have a girls club, really. And no boyfriends were around. No guys were allowed, because it was just a party. So, you know, we had female management. We had three female roadies. And it was just because that's the way we wanted to do it. We weren't feminists. I guess in retrospect, we were, because we were doing it everything on our terms and the way we wanted to do it, but we never had those kind of intentions.
But were you drawn together because you all played instruments, or were you just like, well, listen, we need a drummer, you better learn to play the drums? Or was it, how did that all work?
Well, okay, so we were sitting on a curb in Venice, California at a party, and, you know, Margo said, I want to form a band. And Jane was there, and she said, I want to play bass. I thought, shit, I don't want to play drums. And and then Jane said, oh, I'll play rhythm guitar. She had no idea how to play guitar. And then I said, okay, I'll sing. And then we thought, well, what do we do now? And we went to Margo's apartment, and we're just messing around with her. She had one amp. We only had one amp. And we thought, well, we didn't know how to work the app. So we thought, we got to get somebody that knows what they're doing. So we went to the Starwood, and the Eyes were playing, which was Charlotte Caffey. We thought, Charlotte's perfect because she knows how to, well, plug guitars into amps. So we went backstage after the show, and we said, do you want to join our band? And she said, yes. I mean, it was... She said yes. She says she doesn't know why she said yes, but she said yes. And she really was the one musician in the band. And then we got going. We did a show about 3 months later at the Mask, the first punk club. And our set was three songs. We played one song twice. So that was
Where was the mask? Yeah. Where was the mask? Where in town was that?
It was off of Hollywood Boulevard and Las Palmas. It was behind the Pussycat Porn Theater. And it was down in the basement. So
perfect.
It's perfect. So you have to go through, there's no sign. You have to go through an alley in back of the porn theater and walk down these stairs. And then that's where it was all happening. It was amazing.
Brilliant. That's your equivalent of Soho, isn't it?
In the 70s.
Yeah.
Totally.
Was it Miles Copeland that sort of discovered you? Because I know that you...
No, that was kind of later, wasn't it?
What happened? How did you get the contract?
Well, I mean, we were playing around. We never had a problem with an audience. I mean, we improved quickly. And then I think what changed for us and that whole game is, you know, Ginger came in early. She was there in the early days. We opened for Madness at the Whiskey in, I think it was 1980, I think. And then they invited us to go to the UK to open for them. So yeah, we did.
That's the thing that's amazing. Oh, and the turning point. Well, and because your manager, she sold everything, didn't she, to get to finance that.
She pawned everything. Because back then, before the age of information, you could just write letters back home and say you were big stars and people believed you. There was no other reason, you know, no reason to say, to think otherwise. So we were sending letters back home and, you know, we couldn't afford to make calls and saying, you know, oh yeah, it's great. We're big successes. Ginger, it was a nightmare. That those tours were fun, but they were really hard.
Because you toured with the Specials and Madness. You did the Seaside tour, didn't you?
Oh yeah, we did that
and it was all skinheads and
it was all skinheads.
Larry and
five little girls from Southern California.
And you're all shagging each other.
yeah, a little bit of that going on too. But it was you know, because we told everybody back home that we was a big success, and they believed us. We came back to LA after those tours, and there was we played our first show at the Starwood. It was like the triumphant return of the Go-Go's.
Wow.
And there were like queues of kids like wrapped around the block at the Starwood. And then that's what got Miles' attention, actually. And,
got it.
You know, we had tons of record companies come to all the Go-Go shows, even from the beginning. And they would say, we can see that people love you, but we can't sign you because there had been no track record of like a mainstream successful all-female band.
It's amazing, isn't it? Isn't that amazing?
So there was just kids buying like English magazines, like NME, etc., that had read about this. And is that where, because Our Lips Are Sealed was co-written by Terry Hall. You know what, I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah.
And let's just mention Terry while we're here.
Bless him.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, well, I mean, incredible. Performer and man as well to leave us so soon. And how did, do you remember that happening? Was that with that was Terry and Jane who wrote that song? Was that on that tour? They were on that Seaside tour?
Was it about their affair? Because they were having a secret sort of thing.
They were having a secret thing, yeah. It was a letter that went back and forth from what Jane says. And after we got back to the States from the UK, Jane had just went back to her parents' house because she couldn't afford to live outside the house. So she put it to music. And I guess Terry did at the same time. And that was it. That was Our Lips Are Sealed. So, I mean, I really do think that the two-tone tours that we did here really changed the trajectory of the band. I mean, no question about it.
Could I ask, seeing like the whole thing seems to you, coming from Hollywood and to everything that seemed, you know, whatever it was to us, what was England physically like to you when you visited it? Because it was, you know, it was a shithole.
It was pretty grim. But I mean, you know, it wasn't gentrified or anything. In some ways, it was great. I mean, we had no money. I remember we were given like £3 a day to live on, and we had to get to rehearsal in Shepherd's Bush from... We were in Belsize Park. We had lived in this big house, and we had some of the Bell stars living there. It was a big crash pad.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, how cool.
And like some of the models from LA that would come and they'd stay there. It was like, it was, you know, a great time, but We had three pounds. We'd have to get to rehearsal and back for 75p.
And food was rubbish then.
Well, we ate Nutella and white bread and managed to gain a ton of weight. We took cough syrup to get high because we couldn't afford
Benadryl.
Yeah, Benadryl, exactly.
And I remember Dodos being the thing as well. Sending friends in to pretend they had bronchitis to buy Dodos.
That's so funny. So it was, London was, I mean, it was expensive. It was, but I mean, honestly, we had the best time. You know, we had no money and had the best time.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This episode of Rock on Tours is sponsored by AG1, the daily nutrition supplement.
AG1 is a comprehensive and convenient blend of over 70 vitamins, minerals, and other vital ingredients like gut-friendly bacteria, antioxidants, and much more.
Just one scoop of AG1 daily has all the nutrients you need to support your mental performance, energy levels, heart health, and immune system.
To be honest, it's pretty vital stuff for us, because when you've got a life on the road and you're short of time, or you're too busy to plan and prepare healthy meals, you're getting your podcast together, you're being shouted at, and it's just a nightmare. AG1 gives me all the good stuff and helps keep my energy levels where I need, ready for showtime or doing the podcast, and with a nice vanilla taste.
It keeps me focused, feeling good, feeling healthy with its daily dose of vitamin C and zinc. And it's so easy to use. Just one scoop a day gives me over 70 carefully selected ingredients. Simple.
Trusted by Olympians, F1 drivers and the Rock on Tours. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription.
Go to drinkag1.com/rockontours. That's drinkag1.com/rockontours. Check it out. Who produced that first album, Belinda? Richard Gotterer did the first one.
Yeah.
Because he started Sire Records with Seymour Stein.
And
it's been mentioned on this show before, because I think we had Chris on, didn't we, from Talking Heads, and he was talking about Richard Gotterer. Did Richard Gotterer also produce Joan Armour Trading as well? Because we had Joan last week.
I think he did. And Blondie.
But we've missed out that you had this big change in your fortune, because you suddenly get an actual proper musician in the band, don't you?
Well, yes, we had Charlotte join, and then we replaced Elisa, the original drummer, with Gina Shock, who came from Baltimore to LA and wanted to get into a band. Actually, her drum sound changed everything. It changed the band. It really glued things together.
Yeah. Band was as good as its drummer.
Exactly. It's true.
And we got the beat. When did that happen? Who wrote that?
Charlotte wrote that watching Twilight Zone. Yeah, and she was watching the Twilight Zone. She wrote it in 5 minutes. It's like one of those things that happened. And she was afraid.
But what's the link between We Got the Beat and the Twilight Zone?
She was watching it. She was just spacing out. I know.
It's a bit of guitar.
And she came up with it. It was just like one of those things in 5 minutes that she wrote it. And when we were in the UK touring with the bands, Ginger was trying to shop around the single. And so Sire Records put it out. Not Sire, was it not Sire? It was Stiff Records.
You got one single deal with Stiff, didn't
exactly.
you?
Exactly.
Who wanted the publishing, which Ginger wouldn't give up.
No, she wouldn't. She knew she had heard that you don't give that up. So That actually became a hit in the States on an import single. So that it all kind of it was kismet, the whole thing, you know.
You toured with the Police as well, didn't you? What was that like?
Well, that was like taking five little girls who had been in just playing clubs into playing arenas. And while we were on tour, our album Beauty and the Beat sort of got going up into the charts, and then we knocked them out of number one, and oh, wow, they went down to number six, and we were opening for the time. So they were very good natured about it, though.
Yeah, I've heard Stuart talk about that in a very, very, like he said, they thought it was great because it's that thing. It's like, yeah, you've knocked them off the charts, but they're the Police.
Exactly. You know. Exactly. They are the Police. So that was, yeah, that was traveling around the world for the first time. Yeah, I mean, I have very fond memories of that.
You know, obviously the other albums came out, but there became more and more of an issue between you all that led you to want to go solo. I mean, I think it's okay for me to make that jump.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because we need to talk about your solo career.
Isn't it? The Go-Go's history is absolutely textbook.
It is, and I think it's kind of cliche too. And it's the same story, but for the Go-Go's, you know, it's drugs, ego, and publishing. And
hey, you just talked about my band.
See, it happens.
That's what Gary was going to call his book.
Well, it's such a cliche, but it's you know, there was such a divide in the band because of that. Because, you know, I mean, there's different schools of thought. I mean, we worked our ass off equally for the first 3 years, and there was a disparity between income because of publishing. But at the same time, I mean, you know, I don't know. I can go either way on this, but that caused a big problem in the band, actually.
How much were you writing?
I wasn't writing at all. I was a big mess. I mean, I was having too much fun. And that's why I never felt that it was my place to be able to ask for what I really believed at the time was right, because we had worked so hard. We were like slogging it out, like, you know, for a year and a half straight every day, as you do when you're a young band. And now I'm just kind of like, I can see both sides of the coin. So, you know, but it is one of the things that really broke up the band.
But would you say there was more pressure on you as the front person, or because of the, you know, the novelty of you being all girls, that was split up a bit more? Did you feel a lot more pressure?
Well, that was a problem too, because of course, you know, it was like lead singer syndrome, where people have a tendency to focus on the lead singer, and you know, that caused problems. It was, you know, in retrospect, I do think that we should have taken, you know, we had to say yes to everything as a young band, and in retrospect, we probably should have taken a year, 2 years off, and just...
You haven't got a year.
I know. We could have said no for at least a year.
Yeah, but all of that's irrelevant because in the end, you go on and have a successful solo career. But but let's just finish off on the Go-Go's and say how the story ends in a fabulous way, doesn't it? I mean, you get a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, and in 2021, you get inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Right.
By Drew Barrymore.
Multiple reunions.
Right. Multiple reunions,
yes.
I mean, multiple times in court also, or nearly in court. A lot of suing.
Yes, I think more than once, actually.
Exactly.
Yes, of course. But, you have to have lawsuits too, so.
Belinda, if the Go-Go's were just your career alone, it would be enough.
Yeah.
Because it's pretty fabulous what you have left behind in history, and that now people look back and you've been given the acclaim. I mean, God, I'd love to be nominated or put in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Right.
But so it's a great place to be. How was that, by the way? How was doing that?
It was probably one of the most amazing nights of my life. I mean, it was like what it's like, you know, energetically when it's amazing, and there was just so much love that night, and that was it for us. I mean, actually it was kind of funny, because wasn't that funny actually to the other girls, but we had a show afterwards, which should have been an amazing thing, and I was like, you know, I think I'm done. You know, I think I'm done. And I mean, what is there else is there to do except run around and make lots of money? I mean, it's not, I'm just done. So yeah. We finished up some shows. Everybody ended up on a high note, actually. And everybody has gone. It's weird because we were together all the time for years and years. And now that it's kind of disbanded, everybody just has their own lives and we don't really connect that much anymore. It's weird. But it is not because there are bad feelings. It's just because we're just moved on. So, but it was a perfect ending to the story of the band and its legacy.
Was Pat Smear there?
Yeah, Pat Smear was there because they were playing, the Foo Fighters were inducted at the same time.
I can't believe that. That's so great.
So, it was so sweet. Really, really, really sweet for both of us. Yeah.
And so how did it feel to you when first going solo? How was, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't leave the band because I had a solo career, but I left because it wasn't working and I didn't know how to do anything else. So Miles approached me and I thought, okay, I didn't really what I normally do anyway. I mean, I've done all my life is jump into things without thinking it through and what that means. And so I finished this album and then I thought, oh, what have I done? And then I had to go on stage.
Is this the Belinda album?
Yeah. So it was weird having my security blanket sort of ripped away from me. And I had to really kind of find my way. It took a few years to find my way as a solo artist and be comfortable with that. But yeah, it was a weird transition. And it,
managed you?
Who managed me? Ron Stone and Danny Goldberg back then.
Right. So you completely lost that all female support group.
Yeah. Yeah. It was
weird.
Did
you feel vulnerable?
Yes, I did. It was really scary. Actually, I had Charlotte. Charlotte came because we both left the band at the same time. And Charlotte was, we supported each other through those first few years of after leaving the band because it was all we knew. So it was kind of scary. But like I said, I didn't know how to do anything else. So might as well do a solo album.
I just want to pick up on this, something you just said as an aside, which was brilliant, which is, you know, you've had a full career. When someone asks you a question, you go, yeah, who managed me?
I know. Yeah. Oh, what record company was I on then? I mean, I've been on every label there is, it seems.
Yeah. Did you know what kind of solo artist you wanted to be? And was that first album the right one? Was that who it was you'd planned to be?
You were sort of sticking pretty close, weren't you? It was kind of very 60s-y.
I mean, I was sort of flailing around at that time still, trying to find, I felt like there was a few tracks that were me, like Mad About You, of course. But I felt I was still needed to find where my niche was. And I think that really sort of happened with Rick Knowles, meeting Rick Knowles.
I know, I've worked with Rick. Worked with him with Tina Turner.
Yeah. And then that, I guess I was sort of, he would say probably like a muse almost. And he wrote these songs and these incredible lyrics that weren't literal and that were sort of poetic and that I really resonated with. And I felt that, you know, we worked really well together and he sort of guided me and I kind of guided him on the direction of where it should go.
But just hanging on that first down for a second, there were some great rock and roll players on there, wasn't there?
Oh my God,
Taylor,
I had
guitar,
everybody.
Lindsey Buckingham co-wrote one of the tracks.
Yeah.
I think Nicky Hopkins on keyboard at one point.
Yeah, Nicky Hopkins is amazing. And Michelle Phillips. It was really, really nice that I had like sort of the local music community really supporting me on that. It was pretty amazing.
That's actually a thing that going through, having gone through all your solo albums, you've got all sorts of really fascinating names who turn up here and there. Quite surprised I didn't show up anywhere actually. But Our old friend Nick Beggs shows up at one point.
Oh God, I love Nick Beggs. Oh, he's the best.
I bet you like got a mouth. I bet you got a mouth like a fried arsehole when you read that name, didn't you?
I adore him. I saw him for the first time.
Do you know the funniest one? Sagat Geary, Kadir's brother, guitarist from Funkapolitan.
Is he on the record? Wow,
it's so funny. Yeah,
but Rick Knowles is amazing, isn't he? Because I mean, he basically seems to only ever produce these fantastic women like Celine or Madonna. He's written with, and of course Lana Del Rey, Dua Lipa. I mean, incredible career.
Adele. I mean, Dido. I mean, he's so prolific, and we worked on three albums together, and you know, I mean, those are some of the best songs that I get to sing. Honestly,
how did the those songs? How did Heaven is a place, right?
How did that
heaven
happen?
Is a place. Because this is one thing of that you and Gary have in common is that you both have utterly definitive 80s songs under your belt,
right?
I mean, Heaven is a place on Earth is one of those, right?
Absolutely.
Do you what do you remember of that session and being shown the song? Because I mean, I have to say, not just for you, for all of us living through that time, that song was one of those that you went, wow, that's a step change. You know, suddenly everyone wanted to try and write a song like that. That's great, anthemic, feel good, power pop song.
Right. Well, I remember it clearly. I mean, it's in my very long career, I've had a few times where there's a song that's sort of undeniable and you just go, wow. And if the stars are right, and depending on what's going on in the world and what's going on in music, this could really be a hit song. And that's how I felt about Heaven. It was just kind of undeniable. And, you know, Rick and Ellen Shipley were there and they played it for me. And I was like, yeah, let's go. You know, what do you do? I mean, that and Circle in the Sand, I remember hearing that for the first time.
Yeah.
So, and that was another one of those. And actually when Diane Warren came to show me I Get Weak, and she played it on piano and she sung it. And I said, why aren't you doing this song? I mean, she has an amazing voice. And she goes, I can't sing. I don't want to sing. And so, there's like, throughout my career, there are those moments that I have and I go, wow, you know, this could be really amazing.
And Diane, let's just talk about Diane, because she is an amazing writer who, you know, Aerosmith. I mean, there's so many, you know, people. I love the fact that she wrote Aerosmith, because everyone thinks Aerosmith, that's a great rock band, you know, writes their own stuff. No. Their biggest hit was written by
She owns the end of every major film.
I think
it doesn't really matter who the artist is. Whatever the song is at the end of the film, is she's writing it.
Well, she just got nominated yesterday for her 14th Academy Award. So, and you know, and I have this project that's out now with her, with Dolly Parton and Cyndi Lauper and Gloria Estefan.
Oh yeah. We'll talk about
that. But she's first of all, she has the foulest mouth of anybody I know, and which is great. And she's like, she just turns them out. When I first met her, she had a tiny little office in a 20-story building on Sunset. And now she owns that building, and she built another building on Cahuenga. So, and on every floor, there are big studios. So, and you know, besides being a great songwriter, she's a really nice, normal person. And that's what I like best.
But what I like as well is that this period we're talking about, the singer wasn't in competition with the songwriter. The songwriter comes in, presents a beautiful song, and the singer says, great, I'm going to sing it. When now there'd be four or five other people in the room all claiming a piece of the publishing, all trying to chip in.
Yeah.
You know, the conglomerates that write things now.
Yeah, it's it was, I think, a purer time, if that's a word, more pure time as far as...
Well, because you knew as you could sell records and make money. Now people can't really make the money out of selling the records.
No, you can't. I know. No, we were in there just in time before it all changed.
But you kept moving, didn't you? I mean, actually geographically moving as well. Was it because of was it earthquake related that you left LA?
Yes. I mean, no, actually my husband was an agent at William Morris, and we went to like the 50th anniversary of like the founder of the company. I was at a country club, you know, and everybody was dressed up. And I looked at him, I said, is this where it's all going to end? Is that at the country club? I said, I can't. And so we had sort of decided to, that we were going to, you know, we didn't know where we were going to live. And we went to Mexico and we talked a lot about it. And then we said, eeny, meeny, miny, moe, Australia's too far. This bump, this is not right. But so we decided on France. We went back from, we came home from Mexico and then the earthquake, the big earthquake. And then we left 5 days later. And we just gave ourselves 6 months, you know, we just jumped into it. And people thought we were crazy, but it worked. And we've been expats now since 1994. We've lived in 8 different countries.
Fantastic. So, it was, you were near Fréjus, weren't you?
Yeah, we were in Les Adres, which is near Fréjus. And Dave Stewart lives there. It was like, it was, there was quite an amazing musical community there. So we were there for a long time. And then we've been in Thailand and we're in Mexico now and been in India and Austria, you know, everywhere.
I just want to go back to that sort of moment when you were peaking with Heaven on Earth as well. Because you spoke quite openly about your partying and you spoke about it earlier with the Go-Go's and partying. And to be so successful, was that, how were you playing that game between, you know, remaining creative and forward thinking at the same time, just being enveloped by this euphoria of success?
Well, it was such a whirlwind, as you know, those things are kind of whirlwinds. You're just carried away with what's going on. I knew I was super lucky. And I thought, I'm not going to make the same mistakes this time. You know, I'm going to handle it differently. And of course, you know, it was better in a lot of ways, but I knew I was really lucky. I think I got a little complacent creatively, to be honest, because I had somebody writing this amazing song. So there was a lot of pressure put on me as far as image goes. And that was, for me, was always a difficult thing because I always felt a certain way about myself. And then having to sort of, you know, be not molded, because I always had a say in images and whatever, but you know, I mean, there's a lot of pressure to look a certain way, to photograph a certain way. So that was kind of the drag of the whole bit. But everything else was amazing. Everything is.
And do you think that women have an easier time of it, or a more sort of more powerful experience now than they did then? Do you feel the change yourself, or can you see it?
I think I can see it with all sorts of this body positivity. And I think things have changed a lot, but also at the same time, music's become more sexualized, I think. And I know, I go back to when the Go-Go's, we were performing at the Billboard Awards about 4 or 5 years ago, and we sat in the front row and we could not believe what we were seeing. And we've done everything. And just to see, we were almost like prudes in a way, just seeing these young women on stage being sexualized by men. Of course, they had no say in their career. So I think in some ways it's gotten better, in some ways it's gone way backwards.
And am I wrong? You get someone like Billie Eilish, you know, for instance, who does a brilliant thing of, she's absolutely determined to own what her image is.
Right.
And yeah, and you see that she still comes up against it, you know, madly.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I don't know. I mean, a lot of women who I would call sexualized, or maybe sexualizing themselves, would say it's empowering, but I don't look at it that way. It gets attention, but it's not empowering, I don't think, in any way.
No,
but
I agree.
You're one of the few, especially because you were the first with the Go-Go, so you owned everything you did, you know, in terms of everything from the word go. So you were actually in a kind of unique position like that. That must have been great sort of armor to have going forward.
Yeah, I don't think I know, for some reason no one really messed with me. No one really messed with the band. I never really had any problems and as far as that goes, and I'm lucky, very lucky.
It's still even given that there are so many women successful now in pop music, it's still the production side is still male dominated, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know why that. I mean, I can't think of a female producer off the top of my head, unless you know it's an artist, that's producing their own material. But yeah, I mean, I never really thought of that, but you're right.
Film
seems to be moving.
It does. Yeah, oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Is it me?
Let's talk about this new project before you have to go, because you're doing lots of promotion on it. And the single, I mean, Dolly Parton, Debbie Harry. Who else is on it? Go on, tell us about it.
Cyndi Lauper, Debbie Harry, Dora Estefan, and Dolly, and myself. It's written by Diane Warren, of course, what isn't? And she asked if I wanted to be part of this group, and I said, yeah. And so... everybody did their singing separately. We did the video separately because everybody's busy.
Oh, what a shame.
I know, but who knows? Maybe we'll do something together in the flesh one of these days. But it's a great song. It's the title song for this film coming out, 80 for Brady, with Jane.
But it's called Gonna Be You, right? It's Gonna Be You.
Yeah, it's called Gonna Be You. And it's a great uplifting pop song about friendship. It's good. Really,
I know, it's a real 80s vibe to it, isn't it? I mean, hang on, let me get this right. So it's a film about women in their 80s or approaching 80, and Jane Fonda's in it, obviously, and Lily Tomlin. And so Diane Warren thought, well, then I'll write a song about the 80s or 80s style and get some 80s singers in.
Yes, exactly. And women of a certain age, I suppose. So it works. Yeah. I mean, it was a genius move on her part. So. Yeah, four of the women in the film, and four of us, or five of us, and it's great, it's great. It's I'm very very, it just you know sort of humbled to be a part of that. So
yeah, Dolly Parton, Christ,
I know,
Debbie
it's
Harry,
amazing.
You know,
amazing.
Because of course, your last album was a real departure, wasn't it? Wilder Shores.
Yes. Well, I mean, my last two albums, one was in French, and because I lived in France for such a long time and like love French music. And then because I chant every day and I've been chanting every day for 30 years, I thought I would see if I could put what would normally be Kirtan into a pop song format. So it's all my favorite mantras that I think are really powerful, and it's science. It's not airy fairy. So so I did it, and you know, hardly anybody has heard it. But
what I was going to say, because I loved it, because from reading the titles and when I put it on, I was expecting kind of ambient meditation, you know, like pads and kind of finger cymbals, but they're pop songs.
They're pop. It's Kirtan put into pop song format, which I thought, why hasn't anybody done this? I mean, I love Kirtan. I mean, I'm, you know, big part of the Kirtan community. So I just thought, why not? You know, I mean, and it's very, you know, not very many people know about it, but I'm really glad I made that album. I had to get it out of my system before I did something in English.
So you're going on the road, but is there any new music coming?
Yes, I have a new single coming out, I think in the beginning of March, written by Diane Warren, of course. And it's from a five song EP. The first single, I thought I was going to retire, to be honest. I was like, you know, it's time to slow down. And then my son ran into her at Starbucks and she goes, get your mom on the phone. And she goes,
love that.
And her style, you know, she said, get your ass down to the studio. I have some hits for you. And I sat there, if I don't do this, then it's I'm really stupid. So so now it's coming out in the beginning of March, and it's
so what's it called?
Excited.
Is it big?
The first song is called, the first single is Big Big Love. It's great.
Right. And you're doing a BBC acoustic TV show, aren't you?
I'm doing. Something I'm performing like it on the Piano Room, actually.
On the piano. Yeah.
Because they want one new song, and I just happen to have that. So So it's you know lots
Toby,
of stuff going on.
Toby Chapman playing piano.
I don't know if Toby's going to be there at the Piano Room, but he will, you know, he'll be on the tour. So
give him my best when you see him.
I will.
Yes. Yeah. And James.
I will. They're both good guys.
Listen, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. Seriously.
No, we really appreciate it. We know you've got a really busy schedule, so that's
thank you so much.
Yeah, all right, Belinda,
and I'll see you later. I'm sorry about what's going on with this, but
the halo. You look like
this sort of, it's like something from a beautiful old Disney cartoon. These disembodied.
I don't know what's going on with the lips. No, but everything is so scary.
It's all this glow. Can I just say what it looks like? What it looks like heaven is a place on earth.
I don't know. I don't know. I couldn't look at myself. It's too distracting. Anyway, thank you so much.
Yeah, it's very nice.
Very nice.
I mean, you know, those songs are so iconic, but just playing them recently, I still wish I'd written some of those songs.
I was thinking, you know who I bet absolutely had a fit, and whatever food he might have been eating at the time probably hit the wall when he heard that the first time, is Jim Steinman.
Of course, yeah.
It's probably, why the hell didn't I write that?
Of course. and also Terry Hall, you know, because you reminded me yesterday that the Fun Boy 3 did song as well.
Although I had it wrong. I thought they did it first. Cut that out. My research is immaculate.
And I had it right.
Yes.
Anyway, whatever. But yeah, I just love the idea that the Go-Go's, this L.A. band, were just touring around seasides in Britain.
But I love this idea of the big house in Belsize Park with the model and all these sort of various girl bands popping in and out.
I do, and I don't, because I'm wondering why you and I never, ever got invited to that house.
Yeah. But I was thinking, because I was trying to think what the equipment would have been. There was only the Slits, right, who were terrifying. But because I think the idea of an all-girl band is for when you're young, you know, we would have been in our teens, is like just so fantastic and so intimidating.
Yeah, yeah. Bananarama, I remember being at a TV show with Bananarama in Germany, and there was like a little bar set up backstage for all the acts and various hangers on, and Karen went up to the bar and she said dry white wine, and they gave her three white wines. Germany, which actually was the perfect number for Bananarama, right?
Well, but that was fantastic, and it was, and I loved hearing about, especially about the old punk scene in LA.
Do you know what we didn't mention as well? Brian Eno played on one of her albums.
No, that's right. He was on that list of, because it is a fantastic list of people she's had over the years. You know,
Brian Eno on Viola, the album Viola. Of course, Brian plays on Viola.
He probably didn't play it, but just did treatments.
Or sent some cards.
Brought some trees.
Anyway, we should laugh at Brian. We love Brian.
Brian. We want him on the show. Come on, Brian.
Thank you to our producer Ben Jones for Gimme Sugar, and we will see you next week. It's good night from me,
and it's good night from them.
Rock On Tours is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions for Warner Music Group UK.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.